House Committee on Revenue for April 28, 2015 will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2150.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2150 does a couple of things. First, it prevents additional weights that can be claimed due to double counting when the extended ADMWs, public charter schools, and non-charter schools are calculated independently of each other. And it also specifies the way extended ADMW is calculated when a public charter school ceases to operate. It takes effect on July 1, 2015. Now, a little bit of background information, and we have Representative Springer and ODE folk. Currently, the extended ADMW of public charter schools and non-charter schools are calculated independently of each other. So this has allowed double counting of weights in a school district even when overall ADMW of the school district stay the same, resulting in a higher total statewide weight for the purpose of state school fund distributions. In essence, this bill restores the extended ADMW calculation method that existed prior to 2011-12 school year. Now, let me focus on one particular case, and I'm sure Representative Springer will have a lot to say about this, but without the change in this bill, the moving of a public charter school following the end of 2014-15 school year from one school district to another would increase the total weight, total statewide weight, by about 4,000. So that's a direct consequence of one school receiving an online charter school and another school district losing this online charter school. But the receiving school will add this weight. The losing school will keep this weight if the current law continues. So this bill fixes that big weight distortion. So that's a brief summary of the bill.
Thank you. Representative Springer, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Maybe I should say on that note, if you have any questions, I'll answer them. But that was crystal clear.
Yes. I think your example might be useful.
I think it might. Yeah. So thank you again, Mr. Chair. And actually, this was your bill originally. And we've done some work and some situations have changed. This bill is really important.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm instructed to ask you to state your name for the record.
My apologies. Sherry Springer, State Representative, House District 17. And as I was saying, very important bill. I think if this bill doesn't pass and the funding stays the same, there'll be a pretty big injustice done, quite frankly, in my opinion. So just to back up very briefly, and I know ODE's in the room, Michael's in the room to clean up after me if I misstate anything, and my pride is not on the line. I would rather have accurate facts. So in the state of Oregon right now, a school district can choose they can choose whichever one they want. They're going to choose the larger of the two prior years for their ADMW, and I think that's a good thing. That is there to help districts transition if they're in declining enrollment. Because of that, and remember, a charter school, a bricks and mortar charter school, an online charter school, a charter school is part of a district, so the district receives the funding. In this particular instance, and I'm fortunate to have both these districts in my house district, in this instance, we have a charter school, a large charter school, maybe 3,500 students, leaving a district and moving to a new district. That does occur sometimes. And the new district will have, let's say, approximately 3,500 students more, and they will receive, they'll choose that higher ADM and fund, impart the charter school with that money. Because the school district that, the sending school district or the school district that prior to this change had the charter school, they can choose the larger of the two ADMWs. And likely would choose the larger one, which in this case is, this is where you get to do cleanup if I misspeak, Michael. In this case is approximately $27 million. That's not right. Nobody can justify that both school districts would receive the approximate $27 million. The new district should receive that. That said, there are costs associated with transitioning a school district out. Some of those costs are unemployment benefits, the employer's portion of that. We don't know what that is. There's no way of telling that. That's determinant. There's approximately 9 employees we're talking about or positions. We don't know what that is. It depends on when they get hired. One of the interesting things that has come up, and based on federal law and state law, there are very, very clear requirements for student record retention and storage in this state. Fireproof cabinets, temperature-controlled rooms, all those kinds of things. We can argue if that's right or wrong, but it's the law today that we're functioning with. And that's a huge cost when you think about all the student records. A charter school, online or bricks and mortar, maintain those records until a contract is either discontinued. That encompasses everything. And then those records revert back to a district. That's a big influx in a smaller district, huge influx. And then there's the question of special ed services and to what extent those are continued and to what extent parents who have the choice to maybe claim some of those special ed services, the extent to which they're going to claim those. So let me talk to you a little bit about what the engrossed version of this bill does. I think 100% of that ADMW to be retained by the original district is ridiculous. I think maybe 5% is more appropriate and in line. In this case, in one case in particular, that will be approximately $1 million to transition out. Now, let me talk to you about how that roughly $1 million could be spent. It can only be spent on the charter school's contract being completed. So whatever the expenses would be to transition out of that agreement would be appropriate for this money. Now, if you're like me, especially when things have fallen as these have fallen, as this situation has, I want a lot of accountability. And so I've built in a lot of accountability. So school districts would be responsible for quarterly reporting to the Department of Ed for the first year, the 15-16 year, for that 5%. Those are very clear reports, and ODE has a lot of discretion on what those reports are going to look like. Subsequent years, quarterly just doesn't seem as reasonable because receipts are not flowing at the same level. So for the 3 subsequent years, those would be annual reports. Now, one more caveat in this. There was a lot of discussion of what the right percent is and anticipating these costs, and there's no way under the sun to know what the costs will be. They're anticipated costs. So there is a 3% in addition to the 5% built into this. That 3% will be a set aside at ODE. Similar agreements have been reached in the past with and ODE has done this. That 3% is in the neighborhood of $600,000 to $700,000. If the original 5% is exhausted, and that is proven with the accountability measures put in place. The 3% is accessible. Now, the 3% is only accessible from the original district presenting a receipt that is completely charter school related to the Department of Ed. So it's like when we go to the boss and say, I need reimbursed for this expense, or I have this bill that needs to be paid. And so the money will be released only under those circumstances. In the year 2019, leaves 3 years. In the year 2019, if that 3% or any portion of that 3% is sitting there, which it I anticipate it will be, if that money is sitting there, it reverts back to the general fund and nowhere else. So I think I can give you more detail if you want it. More than happy to do that. Michael may come up after me, and that's your indication that I maybe missed the number. And didn't get something right here. But I certainly will answer any of your questions that you have and strongly encourage you to support this bill.
Thank you. I'm going to take my privilege to ask the first question today. When I proposed House Bill 2150 that was introduced by the Interim Committee on Revenue, the issue that was facing us then was the proposal by a school district in my district to become a charter school district. And one of the arguments that was being made in favor of that was that by doing so in that first year, they would be able to count all the students in the district twice. Once because they had been in the regular school district the year before, and again in the new charter school district, and that the result of that would be that they'd be able to double count because of the rule that says you get to count last year's numbers in the regular district in this year if there's a change or if there's a situation in which that number is more advantageous. They thought that that would allow them to essentially double count for the second year. My response to that when I learned about it was to say I was going to introduce this bill. And the result was that they didn't attempt to do that. I'm wondering if that circumstance is covered under this bill, and that may very well be a question for Mr. Elliott rather than for you. But if you know, I'd appreciate an answer.
I know that Michael Elliott can answer that.
Thank you.
Clearly.
Thank you. Now, so let's go to...
I'm tempted to shoot from the hip and answer that, but I'm going to refrain.
Let's go to Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for this. I also had read about it, and I think it's a great idea. What my question is about is because I was not involved in the state schools fund distribution prior to 2011-2012. My question is, in the bill explanation, in essence, this bill restores the extended ADMW calculation method that existed prior to the 2011-2012 school year. So my question is, Will that impact other parts of the distribution that perhaps were, you know, the focus and the add-on for this particular district is a great idea? And I guess my question is, what else will that impact by that change that we perhaps aren't thinking about or know about, maybe?
Thank you for that question. And Chair Barnhart and Representative Smith-Warner, I can give you a nearly complete answer, I think. First of all, this language is about charter schools. So it specifically talks about that. I don't even know what the language was. There was some iteration of this bill early on. An amendment was brought forward, or maybe it was the base bill that impacted, and I don't even know the names because it was total oversight on somebody's part or just the language fell that way. But there were a couple districts in the state that were impacted by this who kind of said, whoa, why are you calling us out? We've done nothing. And they shouldn't have been. They shouldn't have been. I don't even remember. It was just some language, an unintended consequence. So this language, the part of that I can address is this language has been very narrowly crafted to talk about charter schools that are moving. It is impacting certainly these larger ones. I want to be very clear. that the idea of school districts being able to choose the between the 2 years their ADMW, that makes sense. That was done for very good reason. It gives districts this opportunity if they're in declining enrollment, and a lot of them are. Probably all of mine are, all five of my districts, gives them some opportunity to respond. And in those circumstances, we're talking very small changes, not 3,500 students, and that's a huge number. So I didn't completely answer your question. I gave you the best answer I have, and I'm counting on Michael to fix that.
Other questions?
Oh, okay.
Before we get to the experts?
Oh, okay.
I guess not. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your testimony. And now we'll hear from Michael Elliott and Randy Tranny, please. Thank you so much, Representative, for coming today.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think Day might have had a comment on
that. Oh, Day, do you have a comment? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith-Warner, my state measure summary may have been written too broadly, so this part is just particularly concerning this charter school and non-charter school ADMW, extended ADMW calculation only. So like Representative Springer said, it is very, very narrowly focused, revision of extended ADMW calculation method. So it doesn't affect any other distribution.
Great.
And for those who are new, let me just make a comment about the underlying rule. The underlying rule is that you get to count either this year's ADM or last year's ADM for calculating what your money is. And the reason that we settled on that quite some time ago now, as I recall, was because there were a number of smaller districts primarily that were in declining enrollment situations, and trying to squeeze the number of faculty and other staff down is a complex job, and that simply gave those districts another year to make that calculation. And some districts are in decline, have been in decline for a long time, so they're always working on last year's number. The problem that we had was what I was trying to describe earlier, was that it's possible using this calculation to fiddle with the numbers, and we're trying to avoid that fiddling using through this through the mechanism of the charter school numbers. And so now we'll go to the witnesses who will correct both Representative Springer and myself.
Chair Barnhart, for the record, Michael Elliott, Oregon State School Fund Coordinator at the Department of Education, and there's not much to correct. You both are basically have it correct. I would like to add on to what Representative Springer said. It's not just one charter school, but we have three charter schools, two large ones closing in 14-15 that will impact extended ADMW to the extent that this bill would address. Secondly, Chair Barnhart, to your question, yes, the original preventing of double counting is still in the bill. That would still go forward and would solve some of the other concerns that you originally brought in the bill. And third, Representative Smith-Warner, as I understand your question, you're wondering what's going to happen going forward. Why did we make the change in 2011-12 to begin with? There was an idea put forth that districts in declining enrollment that had successful charter schools that were growing were seeing more of their funds go to the charter school and not seeing the benefit of the increase in enrollment in the charter school. And so the original language was proposed that we'll look at charter schools separately from the non-charter of the district, and that way the district as a whole will realize the increased funding coming from the growth of the charter school. Unfortunately, the way that statute was crafted back then, it resulted in districts being able to open a charter school and then realize the double counting. The original bill did have a clawback provision that said, hey, ODE or Deputy Superintendent, you have discretion to go back and pull that money away from districts that receive that money through this legislative change. We had a couple of districts, I remember Unity and specifically drove all the way from very far east to Oregon. I mean, they could throw stones into Idaho to say that would seriously hurt their districts, and that language has been taken out of the bill. So any money that was distributed through the formula through 2011 change would remain with those districts, but any district moving forward that would think about starting a charter school simply to get the double counting, they would no longer get the double counting. Okay. And I'll answer any more questions. I think Rep. Springer did a really good job explaining where we came from and how the bill works. And Chair Barnhart, I thought you did a good job explaining that, you know, as you open a charter school, you were going to get a zero, and then whatever the charter school's enrollment was in your district would be the same thing, whatever the district was, and go down to zero, and you'd add those 2 years together to get the double counting. And I have submitted written testimony that has that showing up there.
All that description. So, Randy?
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. I'm Randy Traney.
You don't need to hold it quite that
okay.
close.
I'm Randy Traney, the superintendent from Corbett School District, and I checked both boxes for and against over there. first of all, I think the legislation is great, and the way it's written in the engrossed language is much better than the original language. I'm concerned that it's painting with an overly broad brush, particularly around the difference between brick-and-mortar charter schools and online charter schools. Our brick-and-mortar charter school had a dramatic decrease in enrollment this last year. If it had been an online charter school, we wouldn't have had any obligation to provide an education to those kids anymore. But all of a sudden, that burden fell back on Corbett School District rather than the Corbett Charter School. The way language is written around the assets for charter schools right now, they can surplus them, give them away, sell them, all kinds of things. So all of a sudden, we had about 400 more students with no textbooks, no chairs, no tables, no buses to put them in, and the list goes on and on. So I calculated what we had spent roughly this year to buy all those basic classroom things that had left the district, and that was about $1,500 per student. That's already far more than the 5% that's currently in this. Now, had we been an online charter school, then we wouldn't have had to buy those things. So there's a definite difference there. The next thing, imagine that our charter school is totally gone next year, which it will be. We have no idea who is going to pay for the audit for that. 5% of the money will be about $22,000, and the audit itself will cost $18,000 for our little district without any staff time built into it. And then there's all those other things that the district will be burdened with for a long time. TSPC reporting, legal fees, unemployment, which was mentioned, student record storage, employee storage. We're quickly passing that 5% of $22,000. It's a big, complicated picture. The $1 million in one district might be enough to cover all of that, but in a little district, 5% just won't be, and now the burden is back on the district. I don't know if you can fix that. I don't know if there's a way to differentiate between brick-and-mortar charter schools where the burden to educate the kids falls back on the district compared to online charter schools where those kids are going to be in the district they live in, not in the one that sponsored the charter school.
Do you need legislation to capture furnishings and equipment? Probably too late for Corbett, but...
Yeah. I'm not sure what, I mean, we've done it, right?
It sounded as though what I thought I heard you say was that the charter school doesn't have any obligation to give equipment back to the district.
No obligation.
They could have a yard sale if they wanted to. And
I'm absolutely no expert on this, and maybe Michael is, but at the end, a school can surplus stuff as, you know, while they're in operation, and that's exactly what our charter school is doing, or they're just giving it away. So in the end, they will have nothing left, and then the state makes a determination whether that goes back to the district from where it came or gets distributed amongst the other charter schools. However, in our case, there won't be anything left to distribute to anybody. It's all gone. Hundreds and hundreds of computers and textbooks and, like, hundreds. So it was a big hit for us this year.
Is that something we ought to be fixing?
Yes, it should be fixed. I do think it should be fixed. I don't think it's part of this bill.
No, I agree. I just checked the relating clause to figure out it won't fit. Thank you. We have other questions. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Randy, for being here. Help me understand. I think I might know the answer, but again, the charter in Corbett was a part of on the same campus, basically, as mm-hmm. the traditional school.
Yep.
So what you're referring to then, I'm guessing, is that the charter, former charter directors, let's just say, are, now that the decision has been made to terminate the charter, they are retaining possession of all of the IE books,
yep.
computers, that, even though you were there with, again, within the same campus, okay, this is yep. what I'd like the committee to try to understand, same physical confines, they weren't in a separate town, separate entity, separate neighborhood, they were on the charter Corbett campus, so,
yep.
but somehow now they have the ability to take all of those
Yep. So all of those resources that had been purchased for students who are in the Corbett School District, because Corbett Charter School was part of Corbett School District, stayed with the Corbett Charter School Corporation, the nonprofit corporation, and we did what we thought was the right thing and made an opportunity for all of those previous charter kids to continue to go to school in Corbett School District, without any of the resources that have been amassed for those students over time. And, you know, they simply had to have chairs to sit in.
Well,
so
we bought
chairs.
To be clear, the money that they used to do that came from the funds that the district provided through the school funding formula.
Yes, yep.
Representative Smith-Warren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was trying to get some of that same information. I was just going to actually ask, just to confirm, that indeed when that charter school was established, it was funded through tax dollars, through the state school fund,
mm-hmm.
and allocated to the district, who then
yep.
shared or gave it to the charter school. Yet when the charter school ceases to exist, those assets belong to the charter school.
Yeah, those assets belong to the charter school and not the district. And what they do with their assets until they close, as long as they're within the confines of the law, such as surplusing materials that schools can do all of the time, they can do that, and they don't have any obligation to return them to the school district. It's kind of, you know, that's why I said this is it's a broad brush, and there's one particular problem where I can see where this, if this had been in effect this year, it would have been a big hit for Corbett School District.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Other questions? Amplifying that last statement you just made, if it had been in effect this year, it would have been a big hit.
Yep, because
tell
most of that.
Tell me what happened in actual fact as compared to what this bill would do.
Yeah, so we've been able, because we received the double funding, we didn't actually know we were going to receive the double funding until December. We had spent down our ending fund balance to about $200,000 in general fund. And we knew we were going to have to do that this year. We were taking on the burden of these kids should be able to come back to Corbett, and we need to buy them the things they need. So this is helping move our ending fund balance back to where it hopefully should be. Next year, we're going to have a problem if it's 5%. The district will end up paying more than 5% on behalf of the charter school going forward. Mm-hmm. We aren't complaining about anything. The way the language is just fine. There are possibilities for districts to be stuck in a really tight space. Had this language existed this year, Corbett would have been in a tough spot.
Thank you. Yeah, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Michael, I have a question for you. Is this bill too narrowly written to pertain primarily to SIO going forward? And I'll tell you my story personally, which is not unlike Corbett's story. In Hood River County, we had an in-district dual language immersion charter that we had for about 3 years. We closed it about 3 years ago. Again, these are students within our district, and we closed it just because it wasn't making sense anymore. But lo and behold, we get a check from ODE in the mail, which was the double weighting we hadn't anticipated, which was a nice windfall. I think it was plus maybe $1.5 million 3 years ago. But we did not incur any additional costs for those students. We just simply, they were in the same classrooms, providing different curriculum. That stopped. They got their regular traditional curriculum and so forth. So it was a windfall for us. And I think that's what Corbett is realizing now. That's what's helping them bridge their short-term issues. They also received this short-term windfall because they discontinued their charter and they get the double weighting in that year that the transition occurs. So will this forbid that going forward for all districts? That's my question, I guess, to you, Michael.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, yes, this will prevent full double funding for going forward. The 5% was arrived because ODE surveyed the four districts that have most recently closed charter schools, both brick and mortar and online, and their closing costs range between 3 and 8%, and 5% was a compromise. So it wasn't a number just dreamed up to get SIO. It was like, what do we know, what's out there? And the 5% was what came up to say, this is how much. And these were smaller charters. These were bigger charters. I mean, it was online, brick and mortar. It was as much information as we could receive.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I
really appreciate the bringing to our attention this other issue. We've been working on accountability issues for a long time. In fact, the whole time I've been in the legislature since 2001, and that's one that had not occurred to me until today. Appreciate it. Other questions for this panel? Is there anyone else who wants to be heard today on House Bill 2150? Please come forward. Thank you, gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing the Oregon Education Association. It's 42,000 members here in support of House Bill 2150A. And before I explain why we support the bill, I did want to clarify that in the statute on the charter schools, which is ORS 338.105, subsection 6A, it says that all assets go to the State Board of Education of a terminated charter, and that the State Board may then subsequently distribute those assets. So if they were purchased with public funds explicitly, mm-hmm. that is the case. And so if they're starting to liquidate now, I'm sure there is some kind of legal remedy for a cease and desist, because you can also do an immediate termination if necessary. That's also provided for under that same statute. So having said that, I think that there is a legal remedy for that circumstance that was just testified to. We support House Bill 2150 because it does fix both of the double counting issues and protects taxpayer resources so they're most efficiently distributed for the state school fund. And we believe that this remedy is a fix that especially acknowledges those charter sponsors who have a role to provide a regulatory function for the charter schools that they are sponsoring. That is not a state board obligation so much as it is a sponsoring district obligation. And when they find deficiencies, if that exercise of their regulatory power causes that charter then to move to some other place, which could happen hypothetically, they ought not be utterly punished for it by an immediate drop-off of all resources, particularly given that they have other costs. So we think that this strikes the right kind of balance, and we hope that you'll support the bill as amended by the previous committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you. Appreciate it. All right. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2150 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2449. As Chris was on that one. Yes.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2449 deals with biomass. The bill, just very briefly, reorganizes certain statutes. It moves the sunset date for the current biomass tax credit 4 years out, from January 1, 2018 to January 1, 22. It requires the collector producer to hold title to the biomass at the time of delivery. And it modifies certain tax credit rates and allows the Department of Energy to adjust the rates annually up to a change of 25%. And the bill also creates a pilot program for a tax credit based on energy production at bioenergy facilities. Some key pieces of that pilot project is that there would be a biennial cap on tax credits of $15 million. Tax credits could be transferred. Requires the Department of Energy to certify the tax credits and grants the department rulemaking authority. It also imposes a fee to pay for the program and applies to tax years 2016 through 2021. And the Department of Energy is here to provide a brief overview. They have a PowerPoint to go through.
Great. Well, let's hear from the department first then.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Assistant Director for Planning and Innovation at the Oregon Department of Energy. And I'm here today to provide testimony and support for House Bill 2449A. The bill was introduced at our request to improve the existing biomass producer or collector tax credit program and to provide additional promote additional development for the biomass industry in Oregon. I'd like to just take a second to thank the many stakeholders who helped us develop this legislation, several of whom you will hear from today. We really appreciate the many hours they spent to help us fine-tune the proposal. I'll be providing some information about the revenue impacts of the bill, but first I'd like to provide some background about the industry and what the bill does. So bioenergy encompasses a variety of different biomass feedstocks using a range of technologies to produce electricity, transportation fuels, and process and space heat. The existing program was adopted in 2007, and it offers a tax credit to for biomass that is produced or collected in Oregon and used as a biofuel or to produce bioenergy in Oregon. The tax credits available to the producer or collector of the biomass feedstocks, like the one shown on the inside of the oval on this slide. This allows them to deliver the biomass at an affordable price to the bioenergy facilities that are shown around the outside edges of the slide. The credit rates for the specific types of eligible biofuels are set in the statute. And in 2010, ODO began administering the program, and our role is to certify that the biomass is eligible and to certify the quantity that was delivered to produce biofuel or power in Oregon. Bioenergy systems provide numerous benefits. They contribute to our forests and products and food processing industries. They support forest health improvement and water quality protection. They can provide alternatives to landfilling of food and other wastes, and they can save municipalities money. This all while generating renewable energy and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. House Bill 2449A is designed to help the bioindustry grow by improving the existing tax credit program and authorizing a pilot of additional improvements. So I'll be referring to several of the appendices that are in my written testimony. And you'll find those starting after page 5. The first one looks like this slide. And you'll find them all kind of numbered by appendix number and page number in the bottom right-hand corner. So this appendix and appendix 1 shows the existing bioenergy facilities in Oregon. And then appendix 2 right after it has details on the facilities by technology, including the names of the facilities, the year they were installed, and their location. So woody biomass and wood pellet manufacturing are shown as brown dots on this slide. This includes combined heat and power facilities that co-generate electricity and heat from woody biomass. Some of these facilities are currently idle and could benefit from the changes to the program that I'll be talking about shortly. Biomass thermal units are shown in green. These have a variety, include a variety of biomass boilers at hospitals, schools, and other facilities. Biofuel production facilities are shown in blue. These facilities make ethanol and biodiesel from agricultural products and waste oil. Biogas facilities are shown in red. These include dairies and wastewater treatment plants that use anaerobic digestion to convert waste into biogas. And then that biogas can be used to make electricity or transportation fuel. And then landfills that capture biogas are shown in yellow. This slide shows the history of the biomass producer or tax credit program from 2010 to 2014. And it's taken from Appendix 3, which has details on material quantities, certification amounts, and energy produced. So I just included just the pie charts from Appendix 3. And if you look at the bottom right pie chart, which shows the 5-year period from 2010 through 2014, you'll see we certified $22 million in tax credits for about 1.3 million tons of woody biomass, 11.3 million gallons of used oil and waste grease, and 1.6 million tons of animal manure delivered for energy production. Use of these biofeedstocks saved, created, or displaced enough energy to power about 250,000 households for a year. The rest of the pie charts show the tax credits that went in, for each feedstock over time. And the main thing you can see is the change from woody biomass getting smaller in orange and an increase in the manure slice, which is the blue slice. Woody biomass went down mainly because the basis for calculating the tax credit was changed by the legislature in 2011, and changes in market conditions also contributed. And animal manure went up mainly because new anaerobic digestion facilities came online. So House Bill 2449 proposes three major changes to the program. The bill would establish a six-year pilot program to begin to transition the program from incentivizing biomass feedstocks to incentivizing energy production. It would also update the credit rates in the existing program and extend the sunset. I've provided a section-by-section summary of the bill in Appendix 4. The pilot's designed to provide energy production-based incentive for woody biomass, anaerobic digestion, and biomass heating systems. To encourage an increase in energy production, the incentive would go to the bioenergy producer, which were those facilities around the outside of that earlier slide, as opposed to the feedstock producer or collector, as the current tax credit does. The incentive would be calculated for each facility that participates in the pilot based on the difference between its cost to produce the energy and what it can sell the energy for. This would allow them to pay the true cost of the feedstocks that are delivered to their facilities. The program would be capped at $15 million per biennium, and it would, within that cap, fund three types of projects: electricity from woody biomass, heating from woody biomass, and then also biogas from anaerobic digestion. Because the goal is to incentivize increased bioenergy capacity, new restarted or expanded facilities would receive preference, and the projects would be selected through a competitive process.
Representative Smith Warner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask a quick question about that in particular. So if new expanding and, I'm sorry, what was it? I had it on a
restarted.
Are prioritized. What else is there?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith Warner, existing facilities could also switch from the current program to the pilot program, but we would provide preference for newer, expanded, restarted facilities. If those applied, they would most likely win the competition, but we don't know for sure whether they would.
Okay. Thank you.
So the bill includes criteria for the competitive process, and that includes energy production, job creation, emission reduction, and contribution to the state's energy, natural resource, and other and water management goals. A special provision is included for the Port of Tillamook Bay, which operates a community digester. The port could choose between the pilot program or continue to receive feedstocks from producers that participate in the existing program. And then we would report the results of the pilot to the legislature each biennium to enable legislators to decide how to structure the program going forward. So turning to the current program, the bill would update definitions and credit rates and improve the existing producer or collector tax credit program. The credit rate for used oil would be reduced from 10 cents to 5 cents per gallon because this sector is maturing. A new credit rate of $5 per wet ton would be added for food processing residues and food waste. This would help divert food waste from landfills to biogas production. And the credit rate for manure would be lowered from $5 to $3.50 per wet ton, reflecting a lower rate proposed by the dairy industry. The bill would also allow the department to further adjust credit rates by rule after 2017 and within strict limits. This would ensure that the rates reflected changes in market conditions, such as processing and transportation costs and technology changes. And rates could not change by more than 25% in a given year, and the rate for manure would not be allowed to be changed by rule since it would have already been reduced in statute. Also, the bill would allow non-taxpayers, such as ports, municipalities, and tribal entities, to participate in the program. And last, the bill would extend the program sunset from 2017 to 2021. Under the normal cycle, this program would be reviewed and considered for extension during the 2017 legislative session. But stakeholders have told us that reviewing the program so close to the sunset creates uncertainty for some businesses' decisions because it would span the sunset date and the extension dates. So the bill would address this by extending the program 2 years early. However, this may require more discussion since we recently learned that starting the six-year extension 2 years early would put this tax credit out of cycle with other tax credits. Appendix 5 has a timeline similar to this timeline showing the history of the program since its inception in 2007. Here you see the original and extended and proposed durations for the program in the original and current program are shown in red, and then the proposed program timeline is shown in green on the slide. You can see the origin of the program in 2007 through House Bill 2210, the assignment of the program to ODO in 2009 by House Bill 2078, the extension of the sunset and reduction in the woody biomass credit rate in 2011 by House Bill 3672, the exclusion of canola in the Willamette Valley in 2013 by House Bill 3367, and then you can see House Bill 2449A, which is proposed this session. So I've included a copy of the department's responses to the policy questions from the Tax Credit Committee in Appendix 6. The first question asks about the public policy purpose of the credit, which is illustrated in this slide. On the left, you can see the existing tax credit program. This was originally adopted in 2007 as part of a broad biofuels package intended to reduce Oregon's dependence on foreign oil, stimulate markets, and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. It's provided to the feedstock producer or collector, and its effect has been to divert biomass from the waste stream, using it instead to produce renewable energy. On the right, in blue, you can see the proposed pilot, which would focus the program more specifically on incentivizing new or expanded in-state bioenergy production facilities by providing a tax credit to the bioenergy producer based on energy production. We expect this approach to be more efficient and better incentivize new, expanded, or reopened bioenergy production facilities. As I noted, both the existing and pilot programs also provide a wide range of non-energy benefits, such as supporting forest health, nutrient management on dairy farms, and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Without the biomass producer and collector tax credit, less biomass would be diverted from the waste stream to produce renewable energy and these related benefits. So finally, this slide from Appendix 7 shows the projected impact of the bill on revenue from 2015 through the proposed sunset in 2021. So these numbers are not just for this next biennium. This is for the entire extension period. The bar on the left shows the current program with the current sunset at the end of tax year 2017. The middle bar shows the revenue impact from extending the current program through 2021 with no other changes. So that's not being proposed, but that's just for comparison purposes. And that would cost $38.4 million. And then the right bar shows the additional revenue impact of $29.3 million from the changes proposed in House Bill 2449A. The primary changes affecting revenue are a reduction in the credit rate for animal manure, which is the brown bar at the bottom, and then the addition of the pilot, which is in green. So in summary, the Oregon Department of Revenue supports House Bill 2449A to establish a six-year pilot for a production-based tax credit for bioenergy, to make modifications and improvements to the existing bioenergy producer or tax collector tax credit, and to extend the sunset through 2021. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Start at the end, Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my first, I'll just start with one brief one. So the dairy industry, who one would presume benefits from the manure tax credits, has offered that it should be lowered?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith Warner, that's correct, and I'll illustrate that with this slide. As I mentioned, you can see that the blue section has gotten larger, and that's because a number of new digesters have opened recently, so the cost of the program has gone up significantly in that category. The dairy industry has offered to accept a lower rate, lowering the rate from $5 to $3.50 per wet ton.
To make, may I follow up?
Yeah, please.
Thank
you.
Just in an offer of generosity, they offered to decrease the amount of revenue they get?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Smith Horner, in the original bill, we had proposed another solution for this, which was to change the basis for the tax credit from wet tons to dry tons, as the legislature did for the woody biomass sector. So this was an alternative proposed by the dairy industry.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Smith Horner, I'm sorry, Representative Vega Peterson, please.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Andy, for your testimony today. So I just wanted to give the committee a little bit more information about the history of this bill as it was in the Energy and Environment Committee and then the work that's still going on with it. So this was part of a couple different of tax credit proposals that ODO brought forward this session, and this one had to do with the biomass. If you look at Section 11 of the bill, that's where they go into the details of what the pilot program actually does and what how they make decisions in terms of projects that meet the goals of the program. And if you look at the goals of the pilot program that are listed, I think you'll find that a lot of the things that we talk about in this committee in terms of how we're able, you know, what's the purpose of these tax credits? What are we trying to measure? How are we gonna judge the effectiveness are included in those goals. So that's one of the things that I really like about the pilot. And, you know, I think the direction that we're gonna be seeing tax credits going in the future. So this is a good opportunity to take a first step at that. The other thing that I wanted to make sure that the committee know is that there's actually, we have a work group that's going on right now with some of the folks that we're going to be with ODO and some of the folks we're going to be hearing from in upcoming panels. And some of the questions about the numbers in this bill, we still want to have that discussion. We thought it would be better to have that while this bill was over keen eye of the Revenue Committee in terms of the dollars. You know, one of the things about bringing this up early, it's good because a lot of these tax credits, we need to get a leap on looking at the sunset that's coming up because it has an impact on existing businesses. But at the same time, a change like this, making changes like this midstream also have an impact on businesses. And I think the digesters is one of those. And so that's where we're having a continued conversation about dates in terms of when this change that's proposed in this bill will actually have an effect.
Let's see. Who am I? Are we dealing with Representative Johnson, did you have your hand up? I'm not sure.
I was in progress, but you foresaw that, so thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Andy, one of the concerns I guess I have, you know, we're talking about biomass, which we are hoping will lead to bioenergy. But then I see also proposals here for expanding the tax credit to go into issues or products like food waste. And I see one of your bullets at the end of that one slide was about helping related to business and municipal cost savings. I guess my concern would be that we've got a precious commodity here, i.e. in the amount of credits and or dollars that we can make available. And my fear would be that we're going too a mile wide and an inch deep in terms of our ability to truly impact industries which can have a positive impact not on just energy production but on jobs. Would you like care to comment on that and why the department feels it's necessary to expand into some of these more experimental realms?
Yes, Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson. This slide shows the impact of the food processing and food waste addition to the program. It's a small slice just below the green slice. It's not large at this point. And the idea of adding emerging feedstocks to the program is that these are the very feedstocks where the tax credit can be most effective in helping them become established and hopefully become self-sufficient. Mm-hmm. Not all of the feedstocks will be able to become self-sufficient. We think that, for example, woody biomass in some cases is going to continue to need a tax credit because of the cost of collecting it in the forest and transporting it potentially long distances to be used in bioenergy facilities. But other feedstocks, as I mentioned, have become mature and the tax rates can be reduced and hopefully eventually eliminated. So our thinking is that we want to be supporting these emerging technologies at the early stages where it could be most helpful for them. And then as the feedstocks become mature, reduce those tax credit rates and eventually phase them out if possible.
Follow up?
Yes, please.
My question is not about feedstocks, but food waste, i.e. something that occurs in the urban area, certainly. But if we have more of our tax credit going to food waste mitigation, we're having less go into biomass and woody biomass issues out in eastern Oregon where there's a real need for that. So that's kind of where I come from. It seems kind of more of a urban-rural focus, and it's just hard for me to sense that that's in the general interest of Oregon. But I'll let the department make that determination.
So, Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, the food waste currently that is ending up in landfills and diverting it to energy production can not only produce bioenergy that can offset fossil fuels, but also can produce co-products that could be, for example, fertilizers that end up being useful for agricultural production. So that's an example where we've got a pretty good closed cycle between the rural and the urban areas.
I'll follow up with you offline.
Okay, Representative Gatz.
Mr. Chair. Andy, thank you for all your work on this. The question I have probably is best illustrated by going back to your slide that says, that's the slide right there. And I'm interested in the concept of mature and how one would define it and what the Department of Energy's goals are there. So, I mean, it's one thing to talk about biomass and forest health. I don't know when that would finally mature, when all the forests are healthy or the manure digester. Does that mature when people get so good at it, we're paying them for not doing as much as we thought originally they would? In other words, what's the Department of Energy trying to achieve? And I looked at the pilot program just quickly, and it didn't look as if it addressed anything other than energy issues. So that's my question. Is the Department of Energy all about energy, or how do we fold into it these other things like forest health?
So Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Benz, when a feedstock becomes able to be delivered to a bioenergy facility without the tax credits, that's when we would consider it to be mature. And some of the evidence for that are things like long-term contracts, larger geographic scope. So you have a feedstock producer that's got potentially more than one bioenergy facility it can send material to, and that's what's happening in the biodiesel market now with used oil, where it's not as necessary for a tax credit. It's becoming more stable. They've got long-term contracts. They're becoming more self-supporting. There's less support needed. Not every feedstock will go that way. It really depends on the cost structures. The idea of the pilot, though, is to shift away from this concept entirely and move towards a bioenergy production focus, so that we would look actually, instead of at the feedstock, we would look at the facility that's making the energy, look at the cost that it takes to make that energy, including the cost of transporting feedstocks potentially long distances to that facility, and then look at the price that can be received for selling the energy, and that differential is a very specific gap that can be filled with the tax credit and used to encourage more facilities to be constructed. Those, because of the competitive process, those facilities that can do that for the lowest cost, also producing the greatest co-benefits, including things like forest health, would receive preference under the pilot program. So the idea would be to use the tax incentive to encourage efficiency in designing and building new bioenergy facilities that would not only create renewable energy, but also serve a number of the state's other goals.
Please, Jim.
Right, and my question really gets to the final point you made, and that is, how do you measure that value of those things that are not energy related?
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Benz, right now under the current program, it's very difficult to measure. We're hopeful under the pilot it will be more specifically measured, because we'll be entering into performance agreements with the specific facilities that are selected under the pilot, And those performance agreements will include not only the amount of energy produced, but they will define where that feedstock is coming from, and specifically if it were a facility using woody biomass, we would identify which specific forest health projects this facility is associated with. So I think we'd have a greater opportunity under the pilot to measure. To some extent, we can measure under the current program because we do know when biomass producers apply for the tax credit, they tell us which facility that they delivered it to, and we confirm that, so we can track that back as well. It's perhaps not as comprehensive as you have in mind, but it is information that we can develop.
Chair, yeah. I'll just say I'm very happy to be on the work group struggling with these issues.
Very good. Representative Lanning, please.
Thank you. And I'd just like to say I'm really happy to have Representative Bentz on the work group, because we've had some good conversations about how important it is as we're deciding how to allocate scarce public resources to know, have a clear sense of what the benefits are that we're receiving as a community in addition to the costs. And it sounds like you are working on coming up with approaches to make that even more clear. So thank you.
Other questions? We have yes, Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to, in Section 3, in your summary where you talk about non-taxpayers such as ports, municipalities, tribal entities, and nonprofits to be eligible for the credit. So they are non-taxpayers, so one would assume they would be eligible to receive the credit and then sell it to someone else?
That's correct. It's a pass-through provision.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
I've got a bunch of people who want to testify on this. And unless you have specific panels you want to come up in, I'm going to call the people who are more than 100 miles away first, and then we'll go to the others. John Williams, Marty Myers, and Kevin Mass. And gentlemen, we have a bunch of people here from this afternoon, so tell us everything you want to tell us and do it expeditiously. Thank you.
Chair Barnhart and members of the Revenue Committee, and thanks for the opportunity to be able to offer some information on HB 2449A. My name is John Williams. I'm the owner of Quicksilver Contracting Company in Bend. And our company works throughout Central and Eastern Oregon on projects that utilize woody biomass for various products, including the biomass for generation of renewable energy.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. We really appreciate your having distributed your testimony in writing. It makes it a lot easier for us. If you could summarize the really important points, that would be really helpful.
Okay. I guess to me the most important, should the tax credit be extended for the woody biomass component in particular, is what we work in. Obviously, a consistent and predictable period of availability or time frame. That's very important for us as a business, knowing what we're dealing with so that we can prepare bids and then count on the continuity of that is very important to us. And the tax credit rate, the same with the rate. A little bit of variation is acceptable, or we can work with that, but knowing if there is going to be a tax credit, knowing what that rate is going to be, to also include that in our proposals in our operation. And then I would also just probably say that particularly in the east side forests where we work, where the forest health and fuels reduction projects are the most urgent, the tax credit is a key or an integral component of the economic viability of those projects because of the transportation distance that was alluded to earlier. And the profit margins in the production of the biomass are very slim. Sometimes we're working at a loss, sometimes we're working at a little bit of a margin, but it is a very important and integral part at this stage of the biomass removal projects. So I would urge you to approve HB 2449A.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate the time to testify.
Well, and we appreciate your being here very much. stay right there, and because there may be questions. Please.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Moss. I'm from Farm Power. We have two manure digesters in Tillamook County. I'm here today because we've spent some time with the Energy and Environment Committee talking about the less tangible benefits of biomass to energy. We talked about things there like carbon offsets, methane reduction. We talked about manure processing and removal of bad bacteria from manure. But I'm here today because I wanted to talk about revenue numbers, tangible revenue that we pay taxes on. The manure digester industry has been built up just in the past 4 years. If I could ask the staff to go back to, I think, the previous slide showing the timeline, or perhaps it's the slide afterwards. Since 2011, most of the manure digesters in the state have gone online, driven by the availability of the biomass tax credit. The tax credit, we know that it's going to continue for several years. The assuredness of that was what allowed people to invest. From those investments, some $50 million of manure digester capacity, these projects make over $5 million a year of electricity that we sell and we pay taxes on. We sell over $2 million a year of carbon offsets. That ignores the social value of the carbon offsets, which is greater. That's money that we make and we pay taxes on. We sell fiber, which is a cow bedding or a replacement for sawdust. That's over $1 million a year. Our payroll among our projects is over $1 million a year. This is revenue. So it's not an intangible. The manure industry, because we realized that taxpayer dollars for tax credits are a scarce resource, and we knew that the department was trying to find a way to produce savings, we proposed a 30% cut to our rate. Over the next 2 years, 2016 and 2017, the taxpayers will save about $3 million due to those lower rates compared to doing nothing. We wanted to help find a way to make this bill work. We support HB 2449A. As amended, it works for us. We, of course, would love to see tiny changes here and there, but we encourage you to keep moving the bill along. We appreciate the work of the work group. We appreciate the work of this committee, and we would love to see it get to the House floor. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, thank you. I'm Marty Myers, general manager of Three Mile Canyon Farms over in Boardman, Oregon. And again, we're here in support of House Bill 2449A. You've heard from me before, and I've submitted written testimony on the environmental benefits and the social benefits of this program. What we're looking at is economic development at its best. Back in 2000, Tillamook Cheese was evaluating whether to build a plant at 20 different sites across the western U.S., and they ended up selecting Boardman, Oregon. We were successful in keeping an Oregon business and a brand of business in Oregon. And even though we're a large producer, we milk 25,000 cows on our operations, equal to what they milk in Tillamook County. It's a great example of having a large producer partner with small producers in the state. And as Kevin testified before, he's been able to invest in manure digesters in Tillamook County and provide benefit to small family operations there. We also have invested heavily in Boardman, Oregon, to provide economic benefit and environmental benefit to that community. So what I did submit today is a schedule of kind of the numbers that show what kind of investment you make when you build a 5,000 cow dairy. We're interested in increasing the brand power of Tillamook Cheese, and not only cheese products, but they have yogurts, they have Greek yogurts, they have butter, sour creams. We're trying to find a way to have that all manufactured in the state, which requires milk supply. And right now, all of that milk supply in the Tillamook equation is going mostly into cheese. In Boardman, Oregon, it's 100% cheese. So the capital cost of a new 5,000-cow dairy would be about $25 million. If you built an anaerobic digester with that, it would be about $6 million. That's economic activity to the community that these dairies are built in for construction jobs and so forth. The increased sales by that farm would be about $19 to $20 million, depending on the price of milk, which varies. Increased personal income to Oregon employees is $2.5 million a year. Annual goods and services to local businesses. So, you know, dairies are no different than any other operating business. You have parts and service and supplies that you need to acquire on an annual basis. That's about $3.3 million. The biomass tax credit that we're talking about on this size of facility would be $350,000 a year. And the electrical revenue, if we got an average electric price of about $70 a megawatt, would be $588,000. Now, if on the sales, the personal income, the annual goods and services, all of that, that's only at the farm gate. If you are taking that to the processing facility, none of us buy raw milk off the dairies. You send that to the processor, and they make cheese, they make Greek yogurt, and so forth. Basically, there's a 2 to 2.5 times multiple on those numbers of sales, increased personal income to Oregon employees, annual goods and services that are bought from the local businesses. So the biomass tax credit becomes a very small part in this economic activity, and there's a good return for Oregon. So I hope you support this bill. You know, the other side benefit is all of this power that we generate on the farm, the electrons stay on the farm. Now, there's an arbitrage with the power company where we sell the green power back to them and so that they can do what they do as far as developing their green power portfolio. And the reality is the electrons never leave the farm, and therefore we don't have to invest in further transmission and other activities to get the power delivered to urban communities. Thank you for your
time.
Thank
you very much. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Moss, thanks for coming today. Good to talk to you yesterday, too. Appreciated that. I noticed that you're, again, in talking to yesterday, your company's based up in Mount Vernon in Washington. And obviously, they have manure in Washington, too. Could you talk a little bit about incentives or how the state of Washington interacts with their manure in a way to create incentives for companies like you to do what you do and how that is different than what we're considering here in Oregon?
Absolutely. Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson. Washington State, besides being my home, is a place with a little bit higher power prices than Oregon. We were fortunate to start out north of Seattle, where an investor-owned utility pays really higher rates than we've seen anywhere in the state of Oregon, even in Portland or other larger communities. So in Washington State, really, the power companies subsidize our processing of manure through higher power prices. So it's a very convoluted process of where that money comes from, probably from the consumers and the electric utilities. When we made the decision to come down to Oregon in 2011, we knew that the power prices were lower down here, but we also knew that there were incentives such as the biomass tax credit. And when we put them all together, the numbers worked, and we were able to build two projects that serve six farms, milking among them around 5,000 cows in Tillamook County. Does that answer effectively?
Yeah, just to follow up then. So I guess the power rates that you're referring to are just from one consumer utility in Washington. Is that right? It's not across the board, i.e. if you went to the east side of the state, you might encounter a different pricing mechanism for power, and it might not make it as effective for you to invest over there. Is that right? I don't know. I'm just asking the question.
Chair Barnhart. Representative Johnson, yes. On the west side, all of our projects there are one large utility that we sell to, three different projects. There's only one manure digester in eastern Washington, mainly because the power rates there are so much lower, and that digester has struggled enormously. Sitting next to me is an example of a project that benefited from a little bit better rates in Oregon, a little bit better support from the state.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Johnson has triggered some others for me. Do you know what the rate is in that investor-owned utility you're talking about?
Representative Barnhart, we right now make about $100 a megawatt hour or 10 cents a kilowatt hour.
Right, and what do they charge for the power?
11 cents to consumers, so 110. They mark it up very slightly. Mm-hmm. We were just very fortunate that we signed contracts in 2008, 2009, 2010, when prices were higher. Since then, they've gone down.
I see. So you have an extended contract for a while?
Yes.
All right. Lucky you.
Very lucky.
Yeah. And lucky the state of Washington. Thank you. I'm interested in one of the things that this committee does all the time is ask the but-for question. And it goes something like this. If it weren't for this, these various incentives that we're talking about today, would you be in business here? And if so, how would your business look the same or different than it actually does? Several things occur to me. One might be that you wouldn't be processing manure at all, or you might have a smaller farm, or a whole variety of other things. What would be different if this $350,000 biomass credit were not available, or whatever it is the equivalent is for you?
Well, Chair Barnhart, I'd like to comment on that. We went through that analysis when we decided to build a digester, and we built in 2012. And we started producing or processing manure in 2013 through our methane digester. Prior to that time, we processed manure in conventional ways. We did a good job of it. We used the best management practices that were available at the time. We composted all our dry solids. The liquid we still used as fertilizer to apply as a valuable nitrogen source to our farm ground. The digester investment was basically a financial analysis of all the benefits that we could receive from different programs, one of those programs being the biomass tax credit. The biomass tax credit flipped us to an investor in that technology versus prior to you putting that in place for manure digesters, it was a no-go. And I started looking at methane digester technology in 2001, basically when we started milking cows. At that point in time, our partner on that was going to be Portland General Electric. We had a deal that looked attractive because they were looking for a renewable resource, but the Enron issue came up and that project failed. Between that time of failure and 2012, we just could not make a financial justification for investing in this technology. The biomass tax credit, along with some other federal programs, really triggered that initial investment. And I just think it's a critical program if Oregon wants to continue this valuable resource. The other point I would make, this is firm power every day that we're generating. You know, fortunately and unfortunately, these cows don't get a day off. So the fuel source that is the manure is coming at us every day. We process it every day of the year. That means we're producing electricity every day of the year. That's a great resource for the state of Oregon power utilities because one of the complaints they have on some renewable energy sources is that it's not reliable. Therefore, it's not as valuable.
Yeah, right. Thank you. Did you want to comment on that question? Yes, please.
I'll quickly answer your question as well. But for the biomass tax credit, we would not have been able to borrow roughly half of the cost of our two projects, and we wouldn't have been able to build them. Even though we have investors who provided equity, and we did get grants from both the feds and the state of Oregon, we still borrowed about $5 million and for two projects. And our banks needed to see the additional revenue from the biomass tax credit to make that loan. So, but for the biomass tax credit, it wouldn't have happened.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Yes, Representative Whitsitt.
I just had a question. Did you say Washington Power was less expensive than Oregon's?
Chair Barnhart, Representative
Whitsitt. Did I hear that backwards?
Whitsitt. In our area in Washington State, a large investor-owned utility called Puget Sound Energy, the power is more expensive than Oregon, and I believe it's some of the most expensive in the whole region.
Okay, thanks. Right. I just heard it backwards.
Yep. Yes. Thanks. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. I'm going to try to get through the rest of our list. We don't have a lot of time. Robert Frere, Stephen Lawn, let's see. Boy, go down my list. How about the Association of Oregon Counties? Go ahead, gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Chairman Barnhart, Vice Chair Vega Peterson. My name is Rob Ferris with Ferris Lumber Company and Evergreen Biopower in Lyons, about a half hour east of here. We have a 10-megawatt wood-fired electrical generating plant that we began in 2007. Resulted in we hired a dozen people to run it, and it provides the power for about 7,000 homes, plus the process heat we need in our operations. But this being the Revenue Committee, I understand you want to hear the revenue impacts. Our company has about less than 5% of the Oregon Department of Forestry timber sales under contract, and in the next 18 months, we will pay the state over $9 million in stumpage receipts. Our private log purchases will result in about $3 million paid by the timber sellers in income tax and capital gains. Our payroll will result in $2 million in employee income taxes paid to the state. When Measure 66 and 67 passed and was referred to the voters, I asked my office manager if he would take a look and see what kind of non-income taxes and fees we paid, and it was a surprising $3.65 million or $10,000 every single calendar day. We are dedicated to Oregon and to investing in our plants, and in the last 10 or 11 years, we've invested $70 million of our family's money in updating our mills, including this biomass plant. If property taxes are 1.5%, that's $1 million. If it's two, it's $2 million a year. We took advantage of the business energy tax credit. It expires this year, and so if passed as prologue, we'll be paying a couple more $1 million every year in income taxes. The reason I'm here is because we are paid on the avoided cost rates, and as when natural gas prices were $14 a megawatt, that's when we built the plant, and they're delivered at $2.5 to $4 now. And we didn't see an increase or a high rate when we entered into the contract, but we've seen it fall. When my contract expires in 17, it'll be 55% of the rate. So you've heard $110 just a second ago. We're getting $65, and we're going to $38. So this energy tax credit is really important for me to be able to operate the plant. I mean, we can turn off the turbine and lay off those folks and all the people that provide us the feedstock for that plant and still run our process, use the process steam. We could put in transformers in order to run maybe 1 megawatt out of the 10 for our company's usage, but it's just really important for us to if we're only going to get 55% of what we're getting today, that income be augmented in some way.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Stephen Lawn. I'm a biomass utilization consultant. I work with various firms that go out into the woods and process this material, collect it, and then bring it to the various facilities. Definitely appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today, and also the opportunity to work with the working group where we can get into more of the details. I have submitted some written testimony. I'm just going to go over to summarize that real quick. It's something you can take a look at and read at another time, but it supports some of the statements that I'll be making in my summary. Chair Barnhart and members of the House Revenue Committee, the benefits of utilizing woody biomass for energy production, you know, I've summarized that in a summary sheet that I've handed out. There's a couple of items. One is when we're talking about the value of this material, I want to make sure that we're looking at apples and apples when we're talking about bone dry ton, you know, the value that is given for the energy and also value for these benefits that are pretty unique to woody biomass. You know, each sector has these ancillary benefits other than energy production. But when you look at one bone dry ton of woody biomass, you can generate electrical power. It would be equivalent to 1 megawatt hour. And that's enough energy for 800 to 1,000 homes to run for an hour. So the tax credit is based on a bone dry ton. Right now it's at $10. And then we can take a look at what kind of benefits we get for that $10. You know, we can supply dependable baseline energy, and it's a renewable and carbon neutral resource. It's, you know, the woody biomass has a lot of these other benefits. And what you're looking at is avoiding open burning or letting the fuels accumulate in the forest. That's, the alternatives to bringing it in and making energy. So when you're looking at, you know, air quality, reduced risks of destructive fires, habitat restoration, and also stable rural economies, because a lot of this work is being done in the rural environment. Mm-hmm. The Western Governors Association Biomass Task Force put a value to these avoided items. You know, they put a value of $126 a bone dry ton for avoiding open burning, and $202 a bone dry ton for avoiding the accumulated forest growth and overgrowth and the destructive fires that can occur on that. I think you guys have gone through.
Are there some studies on that that you could refer us to?
So the Western
on
Governors,
those two items?
Yes, and in the
that would be. I don't want them today, but it would be really nice if we had them. We could put them in the committee materials.
And sure.
That was going to be a question I was going to ask, and I'm really pleased that you raised it.
Okay. Attachment A is a summary of the Western Governors Association Biomass Task Force report, and then we can also submit the whole report. And their model is,
I mean,
based
that becomes avoided costs in a way, doesn't
correct.
It?
Correct.
Yes.
Correct.
Thank you. Yeah.
And so, you know, in that, you know, you have things like $10 value for the greenhouse gas reduction, and, you know, you have 98% reduction of air pollutants when it goes to a facility that has state-of-the-art air contamination, you know, infrastructure versus open burning. So those items are all in that report. I'll be glad to submit the full report on that. The return on investment for the biomass tax credit, we think, is substantial for all of Oregon. And, you know, when I was going to say on the fire side, you know, you guys have kind of wrestled with this. Oregon's the only state that has fire insurance through Lloyd's of London. You doubled your premium this year, and then your deductible went from $20 million to $50
million. Right. We've heard that bill.
Okay. So those are, you know, I can't put a relationship of how many bone dry tons we move can help reduce those fire costs, but those are definitely some of the benefits that woody biomass brings to the table. We saw a reduction of 50% of our tax credit rate in 2011, and we saw, I thought 2013 was the most data we had, but I just saw the pie chart for 2014. We've even seen a greater reduction in the amount of tax credits utilized by woody biomass. So a 50% reduction, you would have thought, well, this 50% reduction in the use of the tax credit, but it's been greater than that. And that's because projects that were very tight without the help of the tax credit and then matching from, say, the Forest Service on stewardship projects and the amount that the facility can pay with their very tight power contracts, more projects were unable to be done and performed with that tax credit. So in closing, I support House Bill 2449A, and we would like to see a more appropriate rate to move more material. And again, I appreciate working with the working group to kind of go through the fine details on that.
And I appreciate that very much as well. Please.
Thank you very much.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'll keep it really short. I'm surrounded by two experts in this field. I represent the Association of Oregon Counties.
And your name is?
Oh, sorry, Mark Nystrom, policy manager for the Association of Oregon Counties. Keep it really short. We support this bill. We've always been trying to find ways to incentivize the investment in woody biomass, and we think that this is an excellent opportunity to go forward. Like I said, these two gentlemen on either side of me could answer any questions about that, this is a bill that we find is really important for the commissioners and judges of the state of Oregon.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate it very much. Ivan Malewski, Mark Landauer, Michelle Bradley, please. We have another committee in here. Just so the committee knows, I don't have another meeting until 3 o'clock, so I can run late. I hope some of the others can stay. We have another 5 minutes on our official committee time. Please go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Ivan Malewski with Friends of Family Farmers. I'll be very brief since we've submitted some written testimony for the
record that
you can review on OLIS. I would just like to say that, you know, we support small and mid-sized farmers around the state. We supported the bill as it was introduced in the Energy and Environment Committee, specifically around the manure digester tax credit recalculation at the time to $5 per dry ton. Unfortunately, we are now opposing the bill due to the amendment added that we believe is overly generous to on the manure digester side. I want to clarify that for us, projects like the Port of Tillamook Bay's manure digester, where you're collecting manure from a variety of farms, small and mid-sized, and providing municipal power, it seems to be a good use of this kind of technology. What we're concerned about, frankly, is that the bulk of this tax credit and tax subsidy is ultimately going to one operation in Eastern Oregon, which is the largest dairy in the state. We're concerned that the way that it's calculated in the amended bill will actually ultimately, our concern is it could incentivize new, frankly, industrial scale dairies to come into the state to take advantage of the lucrative credit. So a lot of times these larger operations don't really need that sort of help to get established. They have a tendency to push smaller farmers out of business or create price pressures that harm them. So I'd ask you to look very carefully at this subsidy. Perhaps there's something we could do that would make it only available to the smaller and mid-sized dairy operations as opposed to the very largest that we would argue may not need it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Briefly, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Public Ports Association and the Special Districts Association of Oregon, supportive of House Bill 2449. In order to be brief, I'll just introduce Michelle Bradley with the Port of Tillamook Bay and allow her to take any time I might have.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Chair Barnhart, and thanks for punching that, Mark. I am general manager with the Port of Tillamook Bay. My name is Michelle Bradley. We operate, as the gentleman next to me said, a community digester, which is a very different model than a lot of the digesters have. So we actually are under contract with 14 different farms in Tillamook County, farms that would not have been able to have a digester on site necessarily and fund that themselves. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of our different take on things. We don't fit into any box. Most agencies that we work with, whether it's DEQ or we don't work with ag because we're not an on-farm digester, so we have different sorts of things that we have to do, all go into what we do out there with our manure digester. So to that effect, you were talking about the but for this credit, we most likely would have not have done the upgrade to this facility. And we hope to, in the future, have a different revenue sources out there as far as value added, things like that, to help with moving forward with this digester.
Right. Yes, sir.
It should just briefly be noted that the state does have monies invested into Tillamook Bay's digester as well, and so I just wanted to make that known as well.
And what's that?
So when we did the upgraded facility, which you have a pamphlet in front of you for, it was funded 75% by FEMA dollars in lieu of repairing our railroad, and the state had lottery bonds, or bonds that were set aside, for the match, non-federal match for that. So there is a state investment as well as port investment in it.
Bravo. Thank you. Questions?
Thank you.
For this panel? I'm sorry that I don't know the answer to this, because, but I think it's obvious. I suppose somebody thinks it's obvious. What's the difference in terms I'll say it a different way. How many dry tons, how many wet tons do you need to have to, in order to make one dry ton? The way these things are measured.
Chair Barnhart, I'll just say it was my understanding that the tax credit as proposed by going to a dry ton measure, $5 per ton, dry ton versus $5 per wet ton, was approximately an 80% reduction from the existing credit.
Okay.
So that's
so
what
the answer to my question is five.
I'm not sure if that's the answer to your question, but
thank you. Other questions for this panel? Thank you so much. We really appreciate your testimony. Tracy, is it Rutan and Mark?
Jockers.
And then following them, our final panel will be Jody Weiser and Marcia Kelly.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tracy Rutten with League of Oregon Cities, here today on behalf of Oregon's 242 cities in support of House Bill 2449A. I will be also very brief, as I have a true expert here today with me, but wanted to just indicate that we are specifically supportive of the provisions for the credit around woody biomass. It's been something a lot of our rural communities have been very interested in. But also wanted to make sure that we talk with you today about the provision around waste grease, or as we would call it, fats, oils, and grease, or FOG for short, and really see this as an exciting and a really unique opportunity that some of our wastewater providers have been looking at recently. And for anyone who is interested, we did a tour of the Gresham Wastewater Treatment Plant prior to legislative session for several legislators, and would be happy to extend the invitation to any of you. But I will introduce Mark Jockers with Clean Water Services to talk a little bit more about that project specifically. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tracy, Chair Barnhart. Thank you for the opportunity to be here and to talk about a slightly different part of this bill. My name is Mark Jockers, and I work in government affairs for Clean Water Services. We're a water reuse, water resources utility serving about 550,000 people in urban Washington County, small portions of Portland, Lake Oswego, Clackamas County, and Multnomah County. We operate four wastewater treatment plants as well as managed flow in the Tualatin River for water quality and fish habitat. I'm here today representing the Oregon Association of Clean Water Agencies, or Oregon Aqua. Aqua is a private, nonprofit, professional organization of the wastewater treatment and stormwater utilities here in the state of Oregon. We have about 120 statewide members. They range in size from Riddle to Portland. And we are very dedicated to water quality and manage that in a sustainable manner. Our members serve about 2.4 million people. In Oregon, about 62% of Oregon's homes and businesses. Oregon Aqua supports 2449A that will provide a tax credit for biomass producers. The wastewater utilities in Oregon are particularly interested in biomass producers that collect food-related fats, oils, and grease to deliver to treatment plants as an anaerobic digester feedstock. So this is basically an octane booster for our anaerobic digesters. FOG is a terrible thing for municipal sewer lines. It clogs up pipes, it increases maintenance costs, but it can really be a powerhouse in digesters. So I conveniently brought some along with me today. I've been told that under no circumstances should we open this or drop it, because we'd probably have to evacuate the Capitol. But this gives you a sense of really nasty stuff. It's the stuff that makes a lot of our food taste good, too. But it's terrible in sewer lines, but it's fabulous in anaerobic digesters. This fog comes from homes,
we're
restaurants.
We're losing members here.
Oh, yeah, we're already. I thought it was far enough after lunch. Okay. So fog really, it comes from homes, it comes from businesses, it comes from restaurants, food service establishments, and it's a real problem in the sewer collection system, clogging pipes. At Clean Water Services, where I work, we estimate our annual cost associated with this stuff at $4.2 million a year. And that is in reduced capacity, both in the collection system, in pipes, where it clogs pipes, increased energy costs that it takes to treat this when it comes to us, but also increased maintenance in our sewer lines. So typically we want to maintain a sewer line every 3 to 4 years, but years ago we used to have something called Friday night specials, where we knew there were certain lines that would clog because of grease. We've gotten that under control, but there still are lines that have to be cleaned much more frequently than that. By instituting programs to encourage the collection of fog and delivering to treatment plants with anaerobic digestion, we can turn this waste project into a valuable energy supplement and really decrease the cost of the treatment plant and maintenance of the sewer lines, and ultimately protecting public health and Oregon's waterways. I want to give you two examples of where this is used right now. In Gresham, they recently celebrated its net zero accomplishment. They have is one of a handful of wastewater treatment plants in the United States, and the only one that exists in the Northwest that is now net energy zero. So their innovative approach was basically to contract with grease haulers, coupled with the construction of a fats, oils, and grease receiving station, which allows them to bring this fog into their digester as a feedstock, essentially turning waste to watts, I guess you could call it. Since implementing these innovations, Gresham now receives about 10,000 gallons of fog per day from three contracted haulers, which roughly doubles the amount of energy that they're able to produce. Now, where I work at Clean Water Services, our Durham treatment plant, which is located in Tigard, Oregon, recently completed construction of a new energy production facility that includes fog as a feedstock also. We're able to produce about 60% of our energy. Our facility currently receives about 50,000 gallons of fog from four haulers. Ultimately, we can move to 100,000 gallons. And basically what this has done is we've gone from 17% of meeting 17% of our energy needs to meeting about 60. So we've gone from 3.9 million kilowatt hours per year to about 14 million kilowatt hours. And for me, it's about our ratepayers and our taxpayers. And that the value of that is about $700,000 a year that we can help mitigate rate pressures. Now, the city of Pendleton has also invested in a new cogeneration facility that can accommodate fog deliveries. And a variety of other Oregon communities are also looking at the same thing, including Metropolitan Waste Management Commission in Eugene, the city of Corvallis, Clackamas County Water Environment Services, and the city of Hood River. Providing tax credits for fog producers to bring this to municipal treatment plants to generate energy rather than landfilling it certainly supports the upgrades that we want to make in energy generation facilities. It also helps local communities reduce energy and sewer maintenance costs. Energy costs are probably our largest fixed cost at a treatment plant outside of labor. And it also directs scarce public resources to what our focus is, which is water quality and public health. I guess in wrapping up, I just want to say that there are three facilities in the state that currently are using fog feedstock that, and the haulers can benefit from this. And those, again, are Clean Water Services, Gresham, and Pendleton. And the biomass tax credit can really help provide an incentive to properly collect this stuff before it clogs pipes. And more importantly, I think really generate a power and an income source, too, for municipalities. So thank you very much. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you. Appreciate your testimony very much.
Jimmy, leave this.
We'll take that with us.
Take it with you, please. Be very careful with it. Jody Weiser, Marcia Kelly, please.
Quickly, Jody Weiser for the record. Chair Barnhart and Rep. Smith Warner. There are at least three bills from the Department of Energy that ask for sunsets to be acted on now instead of next cycle. And we would recommend that you simply amend that out of each of those bills and any others that come along that do that. We think the parts of this bill that allow for changing of the payment structure makes sense. We do wonder if things couldn't get off of the general fund faster. It sounds like clean water services alone of all of the sewer systems in the state are saving more money than we are passing out in tax credits. So maybe they should be paying for the delivery of the oils instead of the general fund paying for it. And finally, we're concerned about the pilot program, both for the estimated cost and because the department's not been, the department has been struggling. I wonder if they should be starting a new pilot program at this time. But according to the personal income tax records, there have only been about $3.5 million in these tax credits per year for all of the biomass. And so a pilot program that allows $7.5 million a year doesn't sound like a pilot. A pilot's usually a small version of what you're doing, not a doubling of what you've been doing. And so we question that that as a cap, probably should be a lower cap. And you have my written testimony. Thank you.
Chair Barnhart and Representative Smith Warner, my name is Marcia Kelly. I'm the lobbyist for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. I, too, am concerned about having tax credits go out of their assigned renewal dates. People like certainty, but we sort of like the certainty that the staff who are entrusted with really critically examining these tax credits before renewal have time to do that in an orderly fashion. And when people come forward out of order, that puts additional stress on staff. And as I listen to the testimony, I think that at some point some of these programs need to go away. We have enough in the state, or the people have gotten mature enough that the tax credit is part of their bottom line, but does not necessarily have to be there as a bottom line. I think that this is a prime example. In addition to forwarding extensions, there are 15 expansions or extensions and 24 new tax credit bills that have been introduced. And I understand the struggle. I also understand the struggle that the Human Resources Subcommittee has in $140 million worth of cuts.
Thank you. Do you have any questions, Representative? I have one. The issue of the early, so-called early renewal has come up in a number of situations. In all of those instances, the basic argument in favor of an early renewal is in order to manage either the department or the businesses that make use of these tax credits, we need more lead time to know whether the legislature is actually going to renew them and under what with what sideboards or with what conditions. I have to say those arguments seem valid to me. I'm interested in knowing what the arguments are other than that they're out of time based on our artificial schedule that we set up in 2009. Other than that, what are the grounds for not looking at that argument and at least where it's valid, acceding to it? I mean, the point, I guess, is if it takes a business or a series of businesses 2 or 3 years to plan a project, what that means is that when you have a sunset, which is less than that period of time away, they stop work. They don't pick up work again until the sunset is extended at some later time. And so you have this period in the middle where no work is done, or where at least no planning is done. I know that to be a valid argument, at least in the case where the federal government has dealt with renewable energy systems and has been much more dilatory than we've been in terms of determining when to renew and when not to. So what are the arguments that you're really making other than this doesn't conform to the 2009 schedule? What are the other arguments?
Chair Barnhart and Representative Smith Warner. I think one of the things is we saw the slide that this program started in 2007. The department got it 2009 assigned to them. So in those ensuing 6 years, I should think that they would have developed the expertise to be able to do it. The certainty on planning for the people in the business community is a concern, but the concern is, for my part, that they're making investment decisions based on receiving sometimes multiple both state and federal tax credits, and at some point we need to make sure that the state is investing wisely. I just think that we need either more staff to be able to adequately address popping up extensions, or that people stay with the extension, because all of the things were sort of lumped together and sort of like-minded tax credits for the extension, so that you could sort of develop some expertise on dealing with it. Oh, but all of a sudden, instead of dealing with poverty issues, which is the theme of this year's tax credits, I'm looking at biomass energy instead for a bill.
Well, of course, we will be looking at the poverty issues.
No, I'm saying
we'll be going into some detail on those as well. Look, I really appreciate your raising this issue, because I think it's an important issue. I think we also have to recognize that what we did in 2009 was based on a rough and ready estimate, essentially put together by Representative Bailey, and certainly I concurred with the themes that we were talking about and that you just raised. But the reality out in the world may dictate that in order to get an efficient use out of our money, we have a longer lead time on those where that's appropriate. I do appreciate very much the point you make, and the issue that is really important, it seems to me, and this is for the work group too, you can pass along. We really need to understand the economics of these businesses and how the federal supports and the state supports and the local supports fit into that. We've been assured here today by various witnesses that if it weren't for these credits, they wouldn't have made the business decision that they made. That's an important point to me. I think verifying that point or determining that it is not true in some instances is pretty important to us, and it's also something that's very difficult to do. So as we work on what we're going to do, whatever help you can provide in that area would be really appreciated, and not today because we're out of time, but obviously as things move along, we'd be very happy to look at whatever you can produce for us.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Thank you. And I'd just like to say in conjunction with that, and perhaps in closing, another way to think about the idea of sunsetting is when we talk about tax credits as a policy promoter, that we want to promote certain policies. One of the policy I think in general we do not want to promote is one of, and pardon the inflammatory nature of this word, but of corporate welfare. What we want to do is we want to encourage businesses by tax credits, the idea being they will eventually, you support the market until it becomes profitable and they are then self-sufficient and no longer need the tax credit anymore. So, I mean, I think that's another issue that we need to discuss in both the sunsetting idea and just kind of what our policy goal is behind these tax credits, that indeed we do not want to create a never-ending source of, you know, socializing the risk, which is what a lot of this does.
And some of this is energy production stuff. You have to wonder whether the Energy Trust shouldn't be doing it for a large portion of the state. Mm-hmm. They've got $300 million a year that they're spending, I understand. So, you know, that might be another source for much of what's happening. And the point I made about the grease. You're saving $4.5 million on not cleaning out lines, and you're making a couple hundred thousand dollars worth of energy. And we're giving a tax credit to somebody to bring you the material you need. Well, maybe we should require restaurants to recycle their grease into energy, and then we're out of the picture.
Right. Thank you. Look, I really appreciate this. You've raised misallocation of resources, which in the last comment, you've raised issues of how we pay for the use of the commons. In other comments that you've made, all of those things are absolutely valid. How we get from the current system in which we use up a lot of natural resources every year to a system in which we have a sustainability and resiliency is the trick. And every one of these bills, when at least as I think about them and as I filter them, is to figure out the way in which those bills contribute to that. And I will adopt Representative Smith Warner's comments as well, because I think they're exactly right on the point. So I appreciate very much, and I appreciate some of you staying to hear this part, because those are the things that we're trying to get at when we provide tax incentives. And if there are other ways of doing it, like getting restaurants to collect their grease rather than putting it in the sewer line, for example, we should be doing those. That, unfortunately, is not the role of this committee. It's going to have to be done somewhere else. Thank you very much. Thank you all, and with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2449, and the committee is adjourned.